short, artistic version of this morning's sermon. Mine will last a little bit longer than that. I want to invite your attention this morning to the book of 1 Kings. It was a great crowd over in the other service that's running concurrent with ours this morning. 1 Kings. So as we begin this morning, let me ask you a question. If you've ever heard of the two families that I'm about to mention, I want you to raise your hand. The Hatfields and McCoys. All right, good crowd. There's some of you who are probably of a younger generation that think, oh yeah, I've seen those signs up there at Pigeon Forge for the variety show. But there's actually two families called the Hatfields and McCoys, and of course most of you have heard of them. And they are two families that lived on the opposite sides of the Tug Fork River. The Hatfields, led by their patriarch, the Devil Ants Hatfield, lived on the West Virginia side of the Tug Fork River. And the McCoys, led by Randall McCoy, lived on the Kentucky side of the Tug Fork River. And they were known as feuding families. And their feud extended all the way back to 1863. Both families were very lucrative in the timber business. And there was animosity between these two groups of families even before kind of the official feud began. And it was said that the Hatfields used to brag on their wealth, and the McCoys took issue with that. But do you know what started the original feud? It's a little bit murky, but they say it started over a hawk. Over a hawk. Randall McCoy accused Floyd Hatfield of stealing one of his hogs, and it went to court. A few weeks later, on election day, Ellison Hatfield died of wounds that he received from three of the McCoys' sons. Ants Hatfield took it upon himself to kill all three of those McCoy boys, and hence the feud started. And for years and years, there was hatred and bloodshed between these two families. And it all started in a dispute over a hawk. Today, as we continue our series, this series we're calling The Story, this morning's message could be entitled The Hatfields and McCoys of the Old Testament. You know, the last couple weeks we've been talking about David and Solomon. And we've just been, David, of course, was the king, and then Solomon was his successor, his son. And when we left off last week in chapter 10, Solomon was kind of drifting away from God because he was following the gods of these foreign women that he was marrying and taking advice from and trying to please and those kind of things. And as we move forward in the story, Solomon is king, but he is disobeying God. And so God responds by splitting his kingdom in two. And so we have a kingdom that is torn in two. Now here's the thing about division. Division is just not a good word to describe what was happening in 930 BC in Israel. It's a good term to describe America in 2018. There's political tension. There's conflict in the workplace. There's dissension in homes. Sometimes there's splits in churches. Here's what I want you to understand this morning. God's will is for us to live in unity and harmony, without tension, without alienation, without division. He wants us to foster unity whenever possible. Over in Romans chapter 12, verse 18, he puts it this way. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Notice who he puts the responsibility on. He puts it on us. He says, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everybody. Well, this morning we're going to look at some folks that weren't living in peace and weren't getting along. And so I just kind of want to pick up, kind of bring you up to speed on where we were at. We mentioned a couple weeks ago, the last couple weeks, that David and Solomon, that Israel had kind of reached their zenith during these two guys' reigns. I mean, things were just kicking along. Things were going good. These were kind of the glory days for Israel. But then everything just kind of spiraled into chaos. And what I want us to do today is look at what caused the division there. And then I want us to look at that and see, what are some principles? What are some things that we can learn from this story that will help us when we run into conflicts, when we run into division and pitfalls and things like that? So as we pick up the story, Solomon's kingdom is kind of winding down, and two new characters kind of jump into our story. And their names couldn't be more confusing or more fun to say out loud. Jeroboam and Rehoboam. How do you like those names? Try to say that with me. Jeroboam and Rehoboam. So there's these two kings, and their names are kind of confusing, and I remember when I was in school, it was always kind of hard to keep the two straight and figure out which one was which. But these two characters kind of leap out and they come to the forefront. And Jeroboam, we read in 1 Kings chapter 11, had been chosen to be the next king of Israel. And he has been chosen by God. But there's a problem. He wasn't one of Solomon's sons. But God had picked him to be the successor. He was an official in Solomon's court. But he wasn't one of Solomon's sons, and Solomon took issue with that. He didn't like that one bit. He wanted his son, Rehoboam, to be the king. And so we read in verse 43 of chapter 11 of 1 Kings, and it's talking about Solomon, that he rested with his ancestors and was buried in the city of David, his father. And Rehoboam, his son, succeeded him as king. Do you see the problem we have here? We have two kings. We have Jeroboam, who was appointed by God, and we have Rehoboam, who was appointed by man. I like what Barry Cameron says about this. He said, anything with two heads belongs in a sideshow. You know, he's kind of right. I mean, you can't have two kings, you can't have two leaders in hardly any type of organization, and this story just kind of gets worse because of the two kings. And here's what happens. Solomon, during his reign, was very aggressive. And he was financing all these projects the old-fashioned way. He just kept raising taxes. And he built ships, and he built palaces, and he built buildings, and he accumulated personal assets. But he was putting a tremendous tax burden on the people of Israel. In addition to that, he required very intense manual labor from the nation of Israel. So they were overtaxed and they were overburdened. And so after Solomon dies, his son Rehoboam, who's governing part of Israel, he comes and he talks to the elders, Solomon's council, so to speak. And he asked them, he says in chapter 12, verse 7, what should I do? And he's asking the questions, should I continue this plan that my father had? the heavy taxes and the intense labor and those kinds of things. And this is what the elders say. This is what Solomon's men say to Rehoboam, the new king. He said, don't do that. The people are wore out. They need to breathe. Give them a break. Relax the taxes. Relax the labor a little bit. The people need a break. So you know what Rehoboam does? He listens, but he rejects their advice. Instead, he goes to his cronies. He goes to the people that he grew up with. And he asks for their advice, these young guys who he grew up with. He asks for their advice, and we can pick that up in chapter 12, verses 8 and 9 of 1 Kings. But Rehoboam rejected the advice that the elders gave him and consulted the young men who he had grown up with and were serving with him. He asked them, what is your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, lighten the yoke that your father put on us? Continues on in verse 10. The young men who had grown up with him replied, these people have said to you, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter. Now tell them, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions. So what did Rehoboam do? He took the advice of these younger guys. And they're like, no, don't back off. Put the pedal to the metal, so to speak. Grind on these people. Show these people who the boss is. And that's what Rehoboam did. And Rehoboam was basically like this. You think you had it before? Well, let me tell you something. It's going to be like scorpions are in your midst. Kind of a nice guy, huh? Nice guy. As a result, when he gave that speech, this nation that had been united since the days of Abraham, it just tore in two. And so what happened? You had the 12 tribes of Israel that went all the way back to the days of Abraham. You may remember we started talking about that in January. And so 10 of these tribes, they go with Jeroboam, and they make up the northern part of the country. And they were called Israel. I think we have a slide there that you can throw up on the screen, kind of give you an idea. Two tribes, which became known as Judah, they went with Rehoboam. So the Hatfields and McCoys split east and west, and the nation of Israel splits north and south. 10 tribes with Jeroboam in the north, 2 tribes with Rehoboam in the south. And like the Hatfields and McCoys, this division that's created at this time, it extends for a long period of time. The rest of the Old Testament took another 530 years to compile. During all of that time, the kingdom was still torn in two. Folks, division is a nasty place to live. It churns our stomachs. It causes our blood pressure to rise. It gives us feelings of uneasiness. It robs us of joy and happiness. It ruins weddings. It creates conflicts at funerals. It undermines the witness of a church. Sometimes it pits church members against each other. It dashes hopes and dreams. It takes away the innocence of children. It can destroy teams and relationships. It can polarize nations. Division is a nasty place to live. Jesus said this. He said, a house divided against itself cannot stand. In the teaching of the Bible, a house can represent a house, an organization, or an individual. Because individuals can can actually be divided among themselves. So it can be a house, an individual, a family, a church, a business, a nation. And the teachings of the Bible are there because there are so many external forces trying to tear us down. But Jesus is saying, if the members on the inside are unified, nothing can overcome them. But Jesus is also saying, once the members turn against themselves and all these different organizations that we're talking about or individuals, it's just a matter of time until that house crumbles. So the question this morning becomes, what can we learn about avoiding division in our house? Anybody here interested in what the Bible says to have about avoiding division in our house? The Bible has a lot to say about it, but I just kind of want to zero in on four principles from this story this morning. In case of conflict, number one, be careful who you listen to. It doesn't take a Dr. Phil to understand that Rehoboam made a rookie mistake when he goes and talks to his young cronies, the guys that he grew up with, and rejected the counsel of the elders. And then he embraces the counsel of these young guys. If you are faced with conflict, this is for all of us, doesn't matter what age you are, and the only people that you seek the advice of are people that are your age, you're making a mistake. You're seeking advice of people who all have similar experiences to you, and you're not seeking the advice of people who may have had different experiences to you. You're missing the wisdom of people that perhaps have gone on before you. You're missing the insight of perhaps a younger or an older generation on how you should handle a particular conflict or division. And I think most of us who are parents in here this morning have kind of been through this. See if you've ever been through a scenario like this. And it happened several times with my children, more so the boys than my daughters. But you have this conversation, and maybe it's a serious conversation. I mean, it's like a really big decision. And usually these kind of conversations in my family happened when the boys were older teenagers or perhaps young adults. And they would come to me for advice. So this is something that they've initiated. And it's something big. I think it's a purchase of a car or a decision about a major in college or whatever. But it's a big decision. And so we'd have these conversations, and they'd ask my advice, and I'd tell them. And then they'd say something like this. Well, you know, Dad, that's kind of interesting, but I think that I'm going to do what my buddy said. And he'll name off their buddy. And as a parent, you're like, what? What? You're so frustrated. You want to say, because your buddy is how old? And your buddy has what kind of life experience? And your buddy knows this how? Well, that was the mistake that Rehoboam made. And it's the mistake that a lot of us make. But there's even more in our story. Do you think for a moment that Rehoboam's friends are going to disagree with him? He's the king. Do you think they're going to take bad news to him? What are the odds of that? That they're going to disagree with Rehoboam? They have everything to gain by agreeing with him and everything to lose by disagreeing with him. The cost would be too high to tell him something he doesn't want to hear. What I have seen in life, just as a kind of general principle that applies to us today, our friends are predisposed to tell us what we want to hear. Your friends, my friends, when you come to them for advice about a particular conflict or situation, they want to remain your friend. They want you to like them. They want to please you. They don't want to drive a wedge into the relationship. And the cost is too high. And we all need to be aware of the reality of Proverbs chapter 27, verse 6. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. This proverb is telling us you need to have friends that will tell you the truth. And if you are wise when you approach them for about a conflict or a feud or a division, you will beg them to tell you the truth, even if it's hard to hear. And I know sometimes when you do that, maybe it feels like a betrayal and it's hard to hear. You don't want to hear things like that, especially from your friends. You know, it's kind of like sometimes you go to the doctor, right? And you go to the doctor and maybe he says, you know, your blood pressure's a little high. And you know, your cholesterol's high. And you're kind of overweight. And you need to exercise more and you need to eat better. And like, you don't want to hear all that. And then maybe even says, and you know, for someone your age, well, just dig it in there a little bit, why don't you? For someone your age, that really kind of ticks you off, doesn't it? We don't want to hear those things. But we kind of know it's probably for our own good. We need to have friends that will tell us things that we really don't want to hear. You need people that have the courage to speak into your life and tell you the truth. Do you have those kind of friends? You probably need to ask somebody else to answer that question for you. Because you know what? We all tend to say, oh yeah, I got people that'll shoot it straight with me. But a lot of times we don't, because they want to be our friends. Now, if you are a friend here this morning and somebody comes to you wanting some advice about a conflict or some division in their life, I just want to mention two kind of encouraging points from the story this morning. Number one, somebody comes to you. First, ask permission to say how you see it, even if it's not something they want to hear. If they hem-haw around about it when you say that, then probably you just need to end the conversation. The second thing is this. Don't give advice until you've heard the other part of the story. There's always, almost always, two sides. And you know, when we give the narrative, it's just natural as human beings, when we give the narrative of what happened, we always tend to make it kind of slant in our favor. I mean, it's just natural. That's just what you do. We control the narrative. You can almost be assured if you're the listener, you're only hearing kind of their side. Seek permission to hear the whole truth if it means checking with somebody else. And if they tell you they don't want you to do that, then again, you probably just say, well, I'm not the person to ask for advice. Because you know what most people really want when they come to you for this kind of advice? I've seen this over and over. They just want you to tell them that the other person is wrong. That's what they really want. Most of the time, they're not actually seeking advice. They just want you to take their side. So seek permission to get the other side. So point number one, be careful who you listen to. Principle number two, division is seldom one-sided, like I mentioned. Therefore, own your part. You know, at first glance, you look at this story and you think, well, this is all Rehoboam's fault. I mean, if he wouldn't have listened to those young guys, if he hadn't put all these extra taxes on there, this would have never happened. But if you look at the story, you realize that Jeroboam, he had his faults too. First of all, before Rehoboam ever appears on the scene, when this prophet comes and tells Jeroboam, you're going to be the next king, he doesn't want to wait for Solomon to die, and so he launches this coup, and he tries to assassinate Solomon, and it fails, and then he has to flee to Egypt. So he didn't want to wait on God, so he causes some initial frustration and problems there. And then later, we see that after he becomes king, to keep the people, remember, he's up north, Jerusalem is in the south in Judah. Remember that picture we looked at a while ago? So the people need to go to Jerusalem to make sacrifices. Well, he's worried. If the people go south into Rehoboam's kingdom in Jerusalem, then they might start siding with Rehoboam. They might try to kill me or overthrow me. So you know what he does? You're not going to believe this. He creates two golden calves. Two golden calves. We read about it in 1 Kings chapter 12. Jeroboam thought to himself, you know what? The kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David. If these people go up to offer the sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to the Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam. That's Solomon's son. After seeking advice, this is Rehoboam speaking, the king made two golden calves. He said to the people, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out into Egypt. One he set up in Bethel and the other in Dan. And this thing became a sin. The people came to worship the one at Bethel and went even as far as Dan to worship the other. See, Jeroboam doesn't want him traveling to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices. So instead, he builds two golden calves and tells them they can offer their sacrifices there. Folks, do you remember what happened to Moses and Aaron when they built the golden calf? I mean, what is this guy thinking? Doesn't he remember how this worked out the first time? Two golden calves, not just one, but two. Does he not remember? He sells out, not for God, but to protect his own kingdom. That's all he's concerned about, protecting himself. Are you ever like Jeroboam? And you just go completely against what God wants for you? You just kind of start looking out for number one. I know I can do that. I can do that in a heartbeat. And Jeroboam, he just doesn't stop with idol worship. You may remember over in the Old Testament that God had very specific criteria for how you were to select priests. For one thing, they were always supposed to come from the tribe of Levi. Well, Jeroboam kind of gets it in his mind, well, you know, God's not really serious about that, those rules. I mean, you know, it's not that big of a deal if we just do it however we want to. And so he just kind of gets some priests using his own criteria, and they're not from the tribe of Levi. And in verses 8 and 9 of chapter 14, God says to him, you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commands and followed me with all his heart, doing only what was right in my eyes. Then notice the statement that's in blue on the screen. You have done evil more than all who lived before you. Wow. That's a strong statement. You have done more evil than all. I mean, that's like combined. All the people that lived before you. We're told in chapter 12 that it became a sin in verse 30. We're told that a prophet confronted him. In chapter 13, verse 33, it says, even after this, Jeroboam did not change his evil ways. And a few verses later, it tells us that eventually that became his ultimate downfall. Both kings were responsible, Rehoboam and Jeroboam. And after being married for almost 37 years and having five children and being a minister for decades, only a handful of times have I seen a conflict or division that wasn't caused by both parties. And a lot of times it's not 50-50, it's 70-30, 80-20, 60-40. But almost always, 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 out of thousands of times, it's two-sided. But here's a principle of wisdom. You can't control the other person. You can't control their part. You can control your part. And I'll tell you this, a posture of humility creates an environment where healing can take place. Be careful who you listen to. It Division is seldom one-sided on your part. Number three, division has a generational effect. This is what we did with the Hatfields and McCoys. It does with Israel. This squabble that emerges between Rehoboam and Jeroboam, it ripples through their families for generations. Listen to these verses. 1 Kings 14:30. There was continual warfare between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. Chapter 15, verse 6. There was war between Abijah and Jeroboam throughout Abijah's lifetime. Verse 16. There was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, throughout their reigns. And as I mentioned to you earlier, this feud continues all the way through the end of the writing of the Old Testament. But it goes further than that. It goes into the years where there was nothing written. It goes all the way into the New Testament. Some 960 years later, when Jesus is in his public ministry, this feud is still going on. Do you remember when Jesus met the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman? You may not realize that this whole thing with Samaria and the Samaritan woman had to do with this feud that started way back between Jeroboam and Rehoboam. See, the people that lived in Samaria were remnants left over of the northern kingdom where Jeroboam was. And of course, the southern kingdom people hated them. And this hatred had just continued through all of these years. I mean, it was to the point that Jesus was leaving Jerusalem and going to Galilee, so he had to go north, so he had to go through there. But many people, because of their hatred, would walk around Samaria, even though it would take them longer, because of their hatred for Samaria. Then it started 960 years earlier, in 930 BC, and this story was probably in 30, 31 AD. The hatred was still there. And they thumbed their noses at the Samaritans. But not Jesus. Jesus came for reconciliation. He runs into the woman at the well for the purpose of reconciliation. Division can ruin families for years, just like it did the Hatfields, McCoys, just like this example we just talked about. And so the next time you're going to have one of those moments and you're just going to let it fly and you think it'll be all over in a moment, just remember that you could be causing a division that could last for years. Remember the verse we started off with this morning? If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. That should be the mindset of followers of Jesus. This kind of leads us to our last and most important point. Jeroboam and Rehoboam were not the first two leaders of Israel, so to speak, to strike the match of division in Israel. Truth be told, it was Rehoboam's dad, Solomon. Remember the last chapter that we studied when we were talking about Solomon last week? We spoke of how well things were going for him. And we talked about last week how if you're just asking something that you might remember about Solomon, most of us will remember he was like the wisest person that ever lived. God said, Solomon, what do you want? Solomon said, I want to be wise. I want wisdom. And so God just gave him, deposited in Solomon, this wonderful gift of wisdom. And he used that wisdom and it was blessing the nation of Israel because Solomon was using that wisdom that God had given him. But then it just seems like over time, Solomon began to use it a little less and a little less. And eventually, God's blessing seemed to stop because Solomon wasn't using God's wisdom. You know, it's like putting a frog in a kettle of boiling water. If you throw a live frog in a kettle of boiling water, it's going to jump right out. But if you take a frog and you place it in a pot of lukewarm water, and then you gradually just kind of turn up the heat, the frog will stay in that water, and by the time it finally realizes that it's too hot and that it's going to die, its body has already shut down, and it can't get out, and it dies. Do you know what the lukewarm pot of water was that Solomon jumped into? It was marrying all those women. God told him not to do it. And it just wasn't the fact that they were women. It was the fact that they were turning his heart away from God. 700 wives, 300 concubines. Concubines were like legalized mistresses. They didn't quite have the same rights as a wife, but they were legalized, and he could have access to them anytime he wanted. 1,000 women. I mean, there's not a guy in this auditorium that doesn't go, you can't handle two women in your life. Let alone 1,000. This guy's nuts. But it wasn't just the fact that they were women. It was the fact that they worshipped these foreign gods. And here's what happened with him. Little by little, in that pot of lukewarm water, so to speak, he marries these women, and little by little, he begins to worship their gods. And he's turning his heart away from God, little by little. You may remember last week, we talked about one of them was Shamash, was one of those gods. They required child sacrifices. And Solomon is just little by little turning his heart away from God. And he begins to participate in worshiping. And you remember what the first commandment is? Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Solomon knew that like the back of his hand. He knew that commandment. So God comes to him one day, and he gives him this message. Chapter 11, verses 9 through 13. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had been turned away from the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. And we know that to be Rehoboam. He continues on. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. God gave him one tribe because he had made a promise that Jesus would come from the lineage of David. So the final principle is this. If you are threatened with a feud, getting your focus off God is the root cause of division. Division in your relationship with God is the greatest conflict that you can have. A family, a church, a nation, whenever they stay close to God, that puts a wall of protection around them that preserves unity. That means the greatest thing that I can do as pastor of this church to preserve unity is stay close to God. That means the greatest thing I can do to protect my marriage to my wife Renee of almost 37 years and fulfill that pledge until death do us part is to stay close to God. That means to be a great dad, that the thing I need to do most is not attend ball games, although that's a great, wonderful thing to do. It's not to put food on the table, although certainly I should do that. Not to just give them opportunities, although that's a good thing. The thing that I can do to be the greatest dad possible is stay close to God. That's the number one thing that I should do. And it's the same for you. Stay close to God. On Saturday, June 14th of 2003, in Pikefield, Kentucky, Bo and Ron McCoy, along with Ron Hatfield, came together to end their long-standing feud. 60 descendants of the original clans got together to sign a truce declaring an official end to more than a century of hatred and bloodshed. After 125 years, the infamous feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys finally became history. Governors of both states were there and signed the proclamation. June 14th was declared Hatfield and McCoy Reconciliation Day. Ron Hatfield said, "We wanted to show if these two families could reach an accord, so could others." He went on to say that the Hatfields and McCoys symbolize violence, feuding, and fighting. But by signing this, hopefully people will realize this is not the final chapter. Jesus says a house divided cannot stand. The opposite of that is also true. A house united can withstand anything. And that's God's prayer for you, and that's his prayer for me. To be united. I'm going to ask you to do something a little bit different this morning. Here's what I'm going to ask you to do. I'm going to pray in a few moments. Here's what I'd like to ask you to do. There's no pressure here, but just like to ask you. If you are here this morning and you are sitting with family, when I pray and you want to be united in your family, I want you to just reach over and take the hand of family members that are around you. If you're sitting here this morning and you're not sitting with family, but maybe you're sitting with somebody else in the body of Christ, when I pray and you want to be united, you just got to put your hand on their shoulder. You might need to ask them before you do that. So put your hand on their shoulder. And if you're single this morning, because you can be divided, why don't you just place your hand on your heart? No pressure. I want to ask you to do those things.